you all for being here. Had a great week coming off the gospel meeting. Lots of great lessons. Very encouraging. I've heard several good comments. And, you know, all the lessons are up online. So if you have an opportunity to listen to those, then please do. Great series of lessons on the cross. And hope that you benefit from that. Hope you can share it with your loved ones. Definitely something that needs to be preached on more often. We're going to go ahead and pick up in 2 Timothy 3, but let's say a word of prayer before we begin. Heavenly Father, thank you, Lord, for bringing us here today, for giving us the opportunity to have a good portion of health, for having the opportunity to worship you without direct fear of persecution. We are grateful, Father, for the love that you have showered upon us. We are abundantly blessed and privileged. Thank you for providing life abundantly through your Son. Thank you for providing forgiveness. We cast ourselves before your throne of grace, understanding our imperfections and our rebelliousness. We thank you, Father, for your mercy, your long-suffering, and your grace. Pray that as we study from your word this morning, that we have attentive hearts, that we have attentive ears, that we are all doing everything that we can to reflect upon your word properly, to handle it correctly. We are so grateful, Father, for you and for all that you do to sustain this universe that you created. We hope, Father, that our influence can be your influence in this world, and that we would live as people who crucify themselves daily, who take up our crosses and follow after your Son. It's in Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Thank you for our visitors as well. I didn't mention that. We are looking at 2 Timothy 3. We are in the midst, kind of closing out a study on what is commonly referred to as the pastoral epistles, although that's a little bit of a misnomer because the majority of it deals primarily with preachers. And the New Testament very clearly draws a correlation between pastor and elder or bishop, whereas an evangelist or a minister or a preacher, those terms are used for all intents and purposes equivalently throughout the New Testament. We're looking at 2 Timothy 3, verses 1 through 9 today, and I call this the last day because you'll notice that kind of opening expression in reference to the last days. You have, an older translation might say latter days, and some religious bodies kind of develop themselves from terminology such as that. I like the last days. I think that makes more sense, but even when you use that designation, you have to be clarifying to make sure that people aren't misunderstanding things. Let's go ahead and get the text before us. We're going to break it down into verse 1, verses 2 through 5, and then verses 6 through 9. But let's go ahead and read the whole section. Fred, can you read 2 Timothy 3, 1 through 9 for us, please?
But know this, that in the last days, perilous times will come. For men will be lovers of themselves, lovers of money, boasters, proud, blasphemers, disobedient to parents, unthankful, unholy, unloving, unforgiving, slanderers, without self-control, brutal, despisers of good, traitors, headstrong, haughty, lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God, having a form of godliness but denying its power, and from such people turn away. For of this sort, those who creep into households and make captives of gullible women loaded down with sins, led away by various lusts, always learning and never able to come to the knowledge of the truth. Now, as Moses resisted Moses, so do these also resist the truth. Men of corrupt minds disapprove concerning the faith, but they will progress no further, for their folly will be manifest to all.
All right, thank you. So, Fred's reading from New King James. If you are reading from another translation, you might have difficult in place of perilous. Might be one or two other minor, very differences. But again, very synonymous with one another, just two renderings. We are continuing the discussion from chapter 2. You know, we go from week to week and we look at a half a chapter at a time, and sometimes we lose that connection. But chapter 2 talked about those who were approved and those who were unapproved. And so a great deal of what is talked about here are those who are unapproved. And the New King James brings that idea out in verse 8. The New American Standard says rejected in regard to the faith, unapproved would be that idea, again, carrying over from chapter 2. An unapproved workman versus an approved workman. A vessel of honor versus a vessel of wrath. Gold and silver vessel versus earthenware vessel. You know, various different ways of conveying basically the same thing. So what we had looked at in chapter 2, closing out that chapter, was in regards to useful vessels. And now we're looking at unuseful vessels, or vessels for dishonor. So that's where we pick up the discussion here. Again, very much related. Don't want to miss that connection. Now, this chapter begins with a conjunction. So there's a connection. I want to remind us real quick of the thematic outline of the book. And this is very preachy, right? Because you've got this alliteration. But chapter 1 is, and this is again just a general idea, not that there aren't other things that might fit in. But chapter 1, prove your faith. Chapter 2, protect your faith. Chapter 3, practice your faith. Chapter 4, preach and proclaim your faith. So this is kind of our progression. Chapter 3, in the idea of practicing your faith. So we start out with those who are not practicing the faith. And we'll have some references towards the end of the chapter about Timothy and his being trained up by his mother and his grandmother and the sacred writings and his discipline and his commitment to those things. So you start with a negative example. You close with a positive example. Of this idea of keeping to the faith. Of course, our opening phrase here, dealing with the latter days, is the source of some contest between different religious groups. But the latter days is something we should familiarize ourselves with because the Bible uses that expression quite a bit. Peter uses that expression. Paul uses that expression here and in other places. You recall in the first letter to Timothy, 1 Timothy 4, he used that same idea. Again, Peter uses that idea. And New Testament writers are not the originators of that because we have references to the latter days in the Old Testament. And so we should familiarize ourselves to some degree in regards to that. Now, when we refer to the latter days, what do we mean? Or what do they mean? The Christian age. Okay, the Christian age. So, from the time of maybe the resurrection, we'll say, in regards to the new covenant being ratified till judgment, till he returns. Doug, is that kind of what you're going to say? Okay, so how is this misapplied sometimes? Just meaning kind of that very tail end of things, you know. This premillennial system that's developed in the 7 years of tribulation and so on and so forth and multiple resurrections, that being referenced to the latter days. Now, we're going to point out a few things about this that help us to realize that Timothy actually existed in the latter days. He's warned to avoid these people who would be characteristic of the latter days. If he's warned to avoid these people, that would assume what? That they are in existence and that they are currently teaching these things. So here we are, you know, 2,000 years later, a little less than 2,000 years later, and we're still in the latter days. Remember, time, I wouldn't say that time is irrelevant to God. I think he performs and acts in time, but he is above time. And he is timeless. He's an eternal being. And so there's some fluidity in how time is dealt with God, you know. One of the classic Old Testament passages, which is referenced in the New Testament, is a day to him is like 1,000 years, and 1,000 years is like a day. And so we are in the latter days. We are in the last days. And there's a whole field of religious thought devoted to that idea. It's called eschatology. Eschatos or eschaton would be the Greek word for last or end or final, you know, conveying that sort of thing. So that's the field of study that's devoted to that. So when we look at the Old Testament and New Testament, again, it refers to what we might call the Gospel Age or the Christian Age. That's not every passage, because we do have some Old Testament passages which seem to refer to the time before the Babylonian exile or the time before Assyrian judgment on northern Israel. There's a couple of places where it deals with that. But for the most part, it's going to deal not just with the idea of judgment in a secular sense, but in regards to the Gospel Age. That's the way that the New Testament uses this idea. And it is something that Joel had prophesied in Joel chapter 2, That's how Peter began his sermon on Pentecost, referencing Joel 2 and how it was being fulfilled. And Joel referenced that as being the latter days. 2 Peter 3 is another place where people try and make this connection. But 2 Peter 3:3 is not in reference to a future select time, because you find the parallel between 2 Peter 3:3 and Jude 18. Jude 18 references that it's already in effect. Jude and 2 Peter being very similar to one another. So we are dealing with the gospel age. Now, what's going to be characteristic of the gospel age, according to 2 Timothy 3 and verse 1? Be a time of ease and comfort? Are we going to be cows of Bashan, as Amos says in his prophecies? Difficult, perilous times. It's going to be a very difficult time for us. That's kalopos. Kalopos in Greek would be hard to bear, something that's very difficult to bear. It's used in Matthew 8:28 of the Gergesene demoniacs of Legion, and the fact that he was difficult to bear. Remember, they tried to chain him down, the man who was possessed, and he would break the chains. That's the context in which that is used. Another writer, Plutarch, outside the scriptures, used it of a festering and ugly wound. And so it's a very strong word. It conveys something very visible for us. These times of peril and the descriptions that are going to be used, particularly in verses 2 through 5, but also in a sense in verses 6 through 9, are going to be characteristic of the gospel age. Now, we still have undulation, don't we? We have good times and we have bad times in the grand scheme of things. But as a general description, we're dealing with difficult times. We're dealing with times in which the world is in one level or another persecuting Christians. And there's going to be a bitterness, and there's going to be a resentment, and then there's going to be a certain malevolent spirit about the age in which we live. But you do go through undulations. You know, the Romans, for instance, for the first few centuries, would kill Christians nonstop. And since they were the powerhouse during that era, that pretty much was a worldwide view of Christianity. We live in a little bit of a different era. You know, one of the things that we prayed about is the fact that we don't really have to be as concerned about persecution. We understand it's still possible, but it's very unlikely. Of course, we lock the doors and we do everything that we can. We've got a camera. We try and take care of things and make sure that we're addressing those sorts of things, but it's not really actively on our minds. And so we go through this undulation. We go through these ups and downs of greater degrees of persecution, lesser degrees of persecution, and not just kind of on a civil level, but also on a familial level. We might have a lot of kickback from our family during some points in our lives, and then other points in our lives, maybe some almost support, or it might completely flip, and you might see support. So it is difficult. It is a time that is very challenging. And I want to show you one thing first, the fact that these will come. So, one more. Ancient astrologers would use kalopos for celestial convergence. So two things drawing together and causing a celestial explosion. That's the way that they used it. The fact that it will come. Now, Eric, you said that they're currently in existence, right? Well, that's the way it seems, because Timothy is told to avoid such individuals. Now, the phrasing that we have here is difficult times will come. So, to me, the best way of understanding that, given, again, the fact that there is some present tense language that would suggest that it's still in effect, is just to convey that idea of undulation. It'd be very similar to what we see in the book of Revelation, where we have Nero, very early on in the 60s, he's persecuting individuals. And then by the time we get into the 90s, we have Domitian, who really turns the fire up. And then Trajan becomes even more obstinate against the Christians. So there would be times of greater difficulty that are coming, would be the idea, I think, that would convey that a little bit better. Giving an illustration, one of the things that we have been kind of counteracting in our study of 1 Timothy, Titus, and 2 Timothy is the fact that Gnosticism is starting to kind of get legs under it. It's not really going to become full-blown until about the 2nd century and the 3rd century, but it's kind of getting some legs under it. And a lot of these different heresies that they're going to be dealing with are starting to develop, but they're not really going to get their selves together until about the 2nd, 3rd, 4th centuries. And that's when things are going to become that much more difficult. A couple of quotes that I wanted to share with you, because the New Testament is very clear about this being characteristic of the latter days. There are also Jewish writings that foresaw this sort of thing as well, and they're very much lined up with one another. Let me show you two. The first one here is from the Testament of Issachar. The Testament of Issachar is an apocryphal writing called the Testament of the 12 Patriarchs. And Issachar, of course, would be one of those. And this is what this says. I know, my children, that in the last times, or the last days, your sons will forsake simplicity, will cleave unto avarice, and leaving guilelessness, will draw near malice, and forsaking the commandments of the Lord, will cleave unto the liar. And leaving husbandry will follow after the wicked devices, and shall be dispersed among the Gentiles, shall serve their enemies. And do you therefore command these things to your children, that if they sin, they may the more quickly return to the Lord. For he is merciful and will deliver them, even to bring them back into their lands. So that's the Testament of Issachar. And then I want to show you one more. This one's a little bit longer. This is from 2 Baruch. Of course, Baruch, we think of Jeremiah's amanuensis. Of course, this would be an example of pseudepigrapha. This is something that claims to be written by Baruch, but it's not really written by Baruch. So this first half of it, he said, and Yahweh answered and said to me that time will be divided into 12 parts, and each part has been preserved for that which it was appointed. In the first part, the beginning of commotions, stirring up. The second part, the slaughtering of the great. In the third part, the fall of many into death. In the fourth part, the drawing of the sword. In the fifth part, famine and the withholding of rain. In the sixth part, earthquakes and terrors. And unfortunately, there is no seventh part that's listed. It just skips to the eighth part. In the eighth part, a multitude of ghosts and the appearances of demons. In the ninth part, the fall of fire. In the tenth part, rape and much violence. In the 11th part, injustice and unchastity. In the 12th part, disorder and the mixture of all that has been before. These parts of that time will be preserved and will be mixed one with another, and they will minister to each other, for some of these parts will hold a part of themselves, take from others, and will accomplish that which belongs to them and to others. Hence, those who live on earth in those days will not understand that it is the end of times, the end of days, the latter days. And so this was a part of Jewish expectation as well. So the New Testament is very much in corroboration with that expectation. Although the messianic expectations were very different, the expectations of the latter days were pretty similar in a lot of ways. That's verse 1. There's really a lot there that's packed into that. It's only, 10 words or so, but there's just a lot there, particularly in regards to the latter days idea. Any thoughts, questions, challenges? Charlotte?
I just have a note in my Bible that perilous times, mm-hmm. There's times of stress.
Yeah.
I think that really clinches the feeling that people would have.
Yeah, absolutely.
John and 1 John 2, right here, talks about the world's passing away, and this is the hour.
Yeah.
He lived and returned, the same concept.
Yep. Gospel age. Well, let's dig into verses 2 through 5. Verses 2 through 5, depending on how you're going to break it down, is going to have 18, 19 characteristics of these individuals who are teaching in these latter days. There's a couple that can be broken down really into two, but we're going to look at about the way that I broke it down was in about 18. William Barclay, in his little commentary on this, he said, here is one of the most terrible pictures in the New Testament of what a godless world would actually look like. And I think he hit that nail on the head. You will notice also in this listing of verses 2 through 5 that there is an interesting focus on love, albeit perverted love. But they love themselves, they love money, they are without love. There's really an emphasis on that kind of an idea. And that seems to be almost a counterexample to what we have posted up in the lobby. By this, all people will know that you are my disciples, that you love one another. So this would be the opposite. Those who are not God's disciples, those who are not Jesus' disciples, those who have not submitted themselves to the cross, are going to be characteristic of the opposite of love. Not selfless, but rather selfish. Not sacrificial, but rather somebody who would be antagonistic or malevolent. So we have, again, a listing of, roughly about 18 or so, and Timothy is told in this context to depart or flee from these sorts of things. The first one we have is lovers of self. Lovers of self. This is from the Greek word philautoi, philo, Philadelphia, love. Autoi would be self, person, he, she, it. And so that would be the opposite of Jesus' call, as Jim talked about this past week. Christianity is about self-denial. It's about taking up your cross and following after Christ. And so it's not about a love of self. The essence of Christianity is not the enthronement, but the obliteration of self. The second one that's used here is lovers of money. Lovers of money. This is philargyroi. Phila, again, love. Argyroi would be argos, silver. And so it would be somebody who loves silver. That is actually very similar to one of the qualifications for elders. They are not to be lovers of silver. They are not to be lovers of money. Pleasing self demands what? Money. And so if you want to please yourself, if you want to devote yourself to pleasantries, then that requires money. He had warned in 1 Timothy chapter 6 about the danger of money. Jesus had said, it's harder for a rich man to enter heaven than for a camel to pass through the eye of a needle. And so we have this great difficulty that they face. Now, where is Timothy? Going all the way back to what we talked about in our kind of introduction to these classes. Where is Timothy when 1 Timothy is written and 2 Timothy is written? Seems like he's in Ephesus, at least with the first letter. The second letter is written a little bit later on, so it's possible that he had started kind of working his way away from there. 2 Timothy 4, he wants him to draw near. Paul wants him to draw near to him. And so it's possible that he could be outside of the city of Ephesus, but let's use Ephesus as an example. Ephesus, was it a podunk town or was it a live and thriving city? Live and thriving, right? They've got a great trade. They've got great commerce. They're on a trade route by land. They're on a trade route by sea. Very much connected to the world and very much having the finger on the pulse of Rome. William Barclay said, "It is to be remembered that it is always true that a man may lose his soul far more easily in prosperity than in adversity. And he is on the way to losing his soul when he assesses the value of life by the number of things which he possesses." That is a difficulty that we face. We live in a very prosperous time with a very prosperous country, a temptation that we face. By the world standards, every one of us is wealthy beyond measure. What's the next one?
Boasters.
Boasters, or boastful, or some other derivative of that. Alatines. Alatines, according to Kenneth West in his definitions of these terms, he said, is an empty pretender, a boaster, a swaggerer. That person would make a false claim of power. Think Acts chapter 8, Simon the sorcerer. That's the sort of person that we're thinking about. There. Plutarch used it to describe a quack doctor, you know, somebody who comes by trying to sell snake oils. Plato, Aristotle, and Xenophon used it to describe a condemnable man who lies about what he has in order to make a gain. It's used in Latin Vulgate, the same idea, but it's ostentation is the idea where we get our word ostentatious from. Be an ostentatious sort of person. So we are building on that love of money idea, and we build into that the idea of boastfulness. Lover of self, lover of money would be somebody who would be boastful. Think of a vagabond, or think of a panhandler, again, or somebody who's wheeling and dealing a snake oil. That's the sort of person that we're thinking about. The next term is very related to that. What's the next one? Proud or arrogant, or again, some other synonym for that. That would be somebody who contemptuously looks down on others. Theophrastus, an ancient writer, used it to describe a man who had contempt for everyone other than, guess who? Himself. And Theophylact, another ancient writer, called this type of pride the citadel of evils. The citadel of evils. I really like that rendering. Next one. Blasphemers, or anybody else have something different? The slide has something different. revilers. The New Testament talks a great deal about that. Those who are unafraid to revile angels. Now, blasphemer and reviler seems to have a little bit of a different understanding, right? The word that's used here is basically where we get our word blasphemy from. It's blasphemoi. And so a transliteration, New King James Version, other translators are going to convey it a little bit differently, the idea of reviling. Now, we can revile basically two individuals or two groups of individuals. We can revile God, which we commonly refer to as blasphemy, or we can revile those around us, which we don't commonly refer to as blasphemy. Both, of course, would be true of these individuals. This is a sort of behavior that has already been discussed in their regard. 1 Timothy 6, verse 4 is one of those usages that we've seen earlier. 1 Timothy 1 and verse 13 would be another one. So these all seem pretty serious, don't they? I mean, these are egregious sins, we might say. What's the next one on the list? Disobedient to parents. That seems a little out of context. Why is that so serious? Yeah. Yeah. Rebellion against authority. You can have that being developed in the home, and then it becomes, you know, perhaps rebellion against teachers. Then it becomes rebellion against the law of the land, and ultimately culminates, of course, in the total rejection of our sovereign potentate, God Himself. You know, in the Old Testament, what was the condemnation? What was the penalty for being somebody who was a rebellious child? Stoning. Death. In fact, this is the passage which actually leads into he who hangs upon a cross is accursed of God. This is Deuteronomy 21, verses 18 through 21. And that passage in regards to being cursed of God is Deuteronomy 21, verses 22 and 23. The pattern of submission to authority begins at home. And once that is established, obedience to civil and divine authority naturally follow. Now, even the Greeks, even the Gentiles, would withdraw from somebody who struck his parents. That was egregious for them. It was socially and culturally taboo, even in a society that really didn't have high morals. That was against their mores. And that was really on par with murder to the Romans. You smack your parents, you hit your parents, that is absolutely unacceptable, even from a pagan mindset. How much more from a Christian mindset? Another one that seems at first glance to not be all that serious, but once you contemplate it and meditate upon it, it is very serious. What's the next one? Unthankful. Ungrateful. Now, this is literally the opposite of the word that's used for thankful. This is alpha privative, like atheist as opposed to theist. This is acharistoi. Charis, charistoi, Eucharist, sometimes religious bodies refer to communion that way, is the idea of giving thanks for something. And so it's the total opposite of that. King Lear, have you read King Lear? King Lear said, "How sharper than a serpent's tooth it is to have a thankless child." That's exactly what Jim said this past week, right? Hopefully, in years, your children begin to appreciate the sacrifices that you made for them. But if you have a thankless child, even after that years, that's a very difficult thing to cope with. Next one is unholy. Unholy. And again, this is a huge list. I mean, this is one of the most developed lists in the New Testament. I mean, this is longer than the works of the flesh. So this is a very comprehensive list. Unholy, that would be, again, the opposite of holy. That's used in 1 Timothy 1:9 of these same sorts of teachers. This is the offender of the most basic expectations of society. You know, burying the dead, not stabbing somebody as you walk past them on the sidewalk. This is basic expectation. And so it doesn't just have that religious idea. Sometimes we think of holy in a religious sense. It was also used in a secular sense of just not engaging in those sorts of basic expectations. You're not marrying a family member, not engaging in those sorts of things. That's basic. What stems from that is, again, being unloving. Unloving is the opposite of one of four Greek words used for love in the New Testament. This is astorgoi. Storge would be a love that would just be natural. A mother for her child, for instance. It would be a natural sort of thing. So it's got that alpha privative, cancels it out. It is unloving. David Lipscomb in his commentary said, the affection here is common to every class of brutes. Consequently, men and women without it are worse than brutes. This is the sort of thing, again, that Jesus had talked about. If you bless those who only bless you, you do good to those who only do good to you, what better are you than a tax collector? Unloving. We'll do one more and then we'll pause for a minute. Irreconcilable. Where do we most often hear that word?
Divorce.
Number one reason for divorce, irreconcilable differences. What does it mean to be irreconcilable? Not being able to make amendments. And forgive. A quote I found from William Barclay in regards to this. It's actually a negated form of a libation. A drink offering is the one that the word that's used here. So it can mean that a man is so bitter and truculent and unappeasable in his hatred that he will never come to terms with the man with whom he has quarreled. Or it can mean a man that is so dishonorable that he breaks and disregards the terms of the agreements that he has made. So, thoughts, observations about this first two-thirds of the list? Difficult times, right, Fred?
Where these things were, of course, in the world, but these were also in the church.
Oh, yeah.
That's serious.
That's
not only then, but if you've been in the church long enough, you've seen these things.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's something that we have to work on.
Mm-hmm.
You can't look at others and say, well, they are unloving or unholy. You know, we have to be looking at ourselves.
That's a great point. Anybody ever done or fallen into these traps? You have to raise your hand. These are some of the most basic sins. Arrogance, being unloving, being irreconcilable. You ever had a really fierce debate with somebody and you went away just kind of heated? Robin?
Mm-hmm. There's
also
a warning to him, don't
do it. Absolutely. All right, a few more, about eight more or so. The next one that we have here is diaboloi. Diaboloi is typically rendered as malicious gossip. You can have really that divided into two things, actually, which would make our list into 19, but diaboloi, diabolos, what do you think that typically is rendered as?
Diabolical.
Diabolical, or even the devil is actually another translation of that in the New Testament. It's used several times in these letters, often again translated as devil. Malicious gossip, you know, a good name really can't be replaced, can it? I mean, once it's trash, it's trash. Whether you have made that amendment or not, an accusation has the ability to really tear into somebody and tear into their legacy, tear into their heritage. Othello, Iago said this to Othello. He said, good name in man and woman, dear my lord, is the immediate jewel of their souls. Who steals my purse steals trash. 'Tis something. 'Tis nothing. 'Twas mine, 'tis his, and has been slave to thousands. But he that filches from me my good name robs me of that which not enriches him and makes me poor indeed. malicious gossip. These sorts of people are without self-control. Of course, self-control being a fruit of the Spirit, something that we have to pursue self-control and try and set apart that idea of being incontinent. A person who lacks self-control would lack self-control in all realms of the appetite, spiritual and even physical. So gluttony would be an application of this that would fit the context. Brutal is the next one. That would be the idea of savage. This is behavior worse than a wild animal. The King James Version translated it as fierce. And that, of course, is from the Latin word ferus. Ferus would be the idea of a wolf. A wolf or, even a dog. Somebody who would be fierce. Aeschylus, in his writings, used the term to speak of the threatening nature of the people of the city of Pontus, one of the places that Paul had traveled to. They are haters of good. Hater of those who are good individuals might be your rendering. Haters of good things might be your rendering. The word that's used here is philagathoi. Philagathoi would be phile, love. Agathoi would be good. Agathos. The name Agatha, for instance, means good. That would be the opposite of the qualification that is given for elders in Titus 1 and verse 8, where it says they must be lovers of good. These individuals are haters of good. And again, the alpha privative would be on this, philagathoi. They are not lovers of good. They hate that which is good. Next word is treacherous. The Old Testament in the book of Malachi says that divorce is an act of treachery against your beloved. So that would be a biblical demonstration of that. That would be intense betrayal. And think, again, about Roman persecution in particular. You read about Roman persecution and you read, about Nero and Domitian and Tacitus and Trajan, not Tacitus, he was a writer. You read about these guys. And they actually say that Christians would betray each other. They say that in the context of persecution, people would be given opportunities to betray other individuals, and they would give them lists of names to search them out. Now, there's one letter Pliny the Younger writes, and he writes to the emperor and talks very specifically, very candidly about that idea. Sorts of people are treacherous. These sorts of people are reckless. They engage in irrational behavior because of strong emotions, because of prejudice, because of hatred. I'll give you an illustration. We have kind of this big discussion a lot of times about marriage, divorce, and remarriage. People will take a conservative approach until a family member is engaged in that sort of thing. And when a family member is engaged in that sort of thing, then they become more fluid in their understanding of things. They become more flexible. That's the sort of reckless behavior that, again, these false teachers would be engaged in. That's the sort of reckless behavior that sometimes we are engaged in as Christians, something that we have to try and run from. This sort of behavior would be conceited. Conceited, this is the same term, it's a little bit of a different cognate, but it's the same term that's used from the opposite perspective of love in 1 Corinthians 13. It says, love is not puffed up. The word that's used here is the idea puffed up. And it is actually an onomatopoeia, tetufomenai. So it's the idea of being puffed up, full of hot air, we might say. They are lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God. The root for the idea of lovers of pleasure is where we get our word hedonism from. These people are hedonistic. They love hedonistic things. Not all pleasures are wrong, right? But when they become more important than God, they are always wrong. This is a similar idea that is conveyed in the parable of the sower in Luke chapter 8. Where the pleasures of the world choke out the seed. These individuals hold to a form of godliness. Again, this is the difficulty that we face, right? They hold to a form of godliness, but they deny its power. It says, avoid such men, and I would say, character traits. Avoid those character traits as well. Godliness, remember, is a theme that is used a great deal in 1 Timothy, Titus, and 2 Timothy. Let's look at this next section, verses 6 through 9. And we'll just make a few points about this, but I want to share with you an example in history where this happened. It's one of many examples that we can cite. But these would be the methods of these difficult men. These guys are wolves or snakes, whatever illustration you want to use. That was an issue. They would enter households. They would captivate weak women who are weighed down with sins. And one of the things that's talked about here is always learning. It begs the question, who's always learning? The people that are the false teachers? Or is it the women? I personally tend to lean towards the women. I think they have a desire to bring people in order to engage in new things. You know, one of the things that's talked about in Acts chapter 17, there were people at Mars Hill who just loved to learn new things. And so they would invite whoever in to teach whatever, and they would become influenced into doing disastrous sorts of things. The idea of entering is the idea of sneaking. Think of a lion getting ready to pounce on a gazelle. That's the idea there. Sneaky. Sneaky sneaks is what my wife says about people who do things like that. Sneaky sneaks. Weak women is literally little women. Gunai Chiron. Chiron would be little, small, and Gunai would be a woman. They have a broken character. They have a broken spirituality. If you read from the New International Version, they kind of captivate the sense of the idea. They say weak-willed women. That captures the idea, I think, perhaps best. They are weighed down with sin. Something happened to damage them, and they are still having difficulty. Now, the quote I put from Barclay, we are not meant to titillate our minds with the latest intellectual crazes. We are meant to purify and strengthen our lives and the moral vow to live the Christian life. Does that mean that we can't read and develop ourselves mentally? Absolutely not. We're told to love the Lord our God with all of our mind. And so titillating with just latest intellectual crazes is a big difference from that. Now, let me read something from you. Irenaeus is one, he wrote about 175. And Irenaeus has a book that he wrote called Against Heresies. And he talks about a guy named Marcus. Marcus and his disciples. And Marcus was an alleged magician, and he had deceived many and drawn them away. Let me share a few quotes with you about this. Irenaeus said, "He devotes himself, Marcus, especially to women, those such as are well-bred and elegantly attired and of great wealth, whom he frequently seeks to draw after him by addressing them in seductive words." After continuing about his methodology, he says, "She, the woman he is pursuing, then makes the effort to reward him, not only by the gift of her possessions, in which way he has collected a very large fortune, but also by yielding up to him her person, desiring in every way to be united to him, that she may become altogether one with him." He gives another example. He says, "Moreover, that this Marcus compounds philtres and love potions in order to insult the persons of some of these women, if not of all those of them who have returned to the church of God, a thing which frequently occurs, have acknowledged, confessing too, that they have been defiled by him, that they were filled with a burning passion towards him. Sad example of this occurred in the case of a certain Asiatic, one of our deacons, who had received him, Marcus, into his house. His wife, a woman of remarkable beauty, fell a victim both in mind and body to this magician." Sneaky sneaks. One of the things you often see with cults is the leader of the cult will draw people in for sexual purposes. One last quote, slide, and this is Janus and Jambres. Janus and Jambres would be characteristic of this sort of behavior. Janus and Jambres traditionally, and it would seem here biblically, were the Egyptian magicians that opposed Moses. They oppose the truth. They are depraved in mind. They are rejected by the faith. And he says they will make no further progress. Of course, that's contingent upon us being devoted ourselves. Their folly is obvious to all if you have the eyes to see it. That wraps up 2 Timothy 3, verses 1 through 9. Next time we'll look at the rest of the chapter, the positive example. Thank you for the class, everyone.